This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Of course, every suspect is innocent until proven guilty. Everyone is entitled to due process and a fair trial. But there are times when some might wonder why. When Arizona's shooting suspect Jared Lee Loeffner appears in court, it's hard to believe that a single juror will doubt his responsibility for killing six people and wounding 13 others. He's got an experienced lawyer. Judy Clark represented Unabomber Theodore Kaczynski and September the 11th conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui. But how do you mount a defense in a notorious case where many of the facts are not in dispute? We want to hear from those of you who've been involved in such cases where the defendant's guilt was not in question, from defense lawyers, prosecutors, victims, and jurors. Tell us your story. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, William H. Macy on his new TV show, Shameless. But first, defending the indefensible, and we begin with Jonathan Turley, a professor of public interest law at the George Washington University. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back on the program.
Hi, Neil.
And if you're involved in one of these cases as a defense attorney, what's your first step?
Well, your first step is obviously to see what your liabilities are. Sometimes that's perfectly clear. Your client's guilt may not be seriously in question, but there still is a question as to whether his guilt can be proven. As his advocate, you have to put aside many natural feelings. I've had clients in my past that I felt were not just obnoxious, but revolting for what they've done. But that's not your job. And so you look at the case and you see what's the best case that can be made. Often that is not a question necessarily of guilt, as it is for the level of guilt and the degree of punishment that would come from it.
So minimize the penalty is what you're looking to do.
That's right.
Perhaps. There are any number of options available. First of all, I assume you always plead not guilty.
Yes. Yeah, you do plead not guilty. It is possible to not enter a plea and to have the federal judge enter the plea for you. If you choose not to enter a plea, the judge will enter a plea of not guilty. But most of the time you plead not guilty or you don't enter a plea, and then you deal it from that point on. When you don't enter a plea, it often is an indication that you're speaking with the prosecutors for a possible plea agreement. But there's other reasons to do that.
And like?
Well, part of it is that, you know, your client may still be deciding whether he or she wants to plead guilty or admit to certain facts, certain charges in the indictment. Sometimes it's because you just got into the case and you want more time to speak with your client. Then there's also times where you're not sure your client is entirely competent to answer those questions.
And that's another issue. You then go into an exploration of the competence to stand trial because a defendant must be able to participate in their own defense. There is also the selection of a perhaps a guilty but innocent by reason of mental defect. And that is a very risky business.
It is. It's a better defense to make on television than it is in a courtroom.
It works a fair percentage of the time on TV.
Yes. The attorneys look a lot better in those cases as well. But when you have to make one of these in court, they tend to be heavily disfavored by both the court and the jury. Part of the problem is the standard. There's a standard called the McNaughton Standard, which it came from a case in 1843 where an individual tried to assassinate the British Prime Minister. And the House of Lords came up with a standard that said that you could be innocent by reason of insanity if you could show that you didn't understand the nature and quality of the act or that you did not understand it was wrong. Well, the McNaughton Standard is a fairly harsh standard. In the United States, we went to what was called a Durham Standard, which really asks whether the act was the product of mental disease. That's a standard that many people in the field, that the psychiatric and psychological bodies, favored. But after Ronald Reagan's attempted assassination by John Hinckley, legislators were outraged that Hinckley was able to use the insanity defense. And so they ripped up insanity laws across the country. One of the things that was lost is this idea of committing an act where you were compelled by your mental illness, even if you knew it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be critical in a case like Tucson.
Yeah, and we should point out John Hinckley, the assassination attempt was a long time ago. He is still in a mental institution here in Washington, D.C.
That's right.
there is then the case, and Mr. Loeffner is going to face this, he faces federal charges, but he will also face state charges and is at risk of the death penalty at both phases.
Yeah, this is going to be, unfortunately, like the D.C. sniper case, where you had various states and the federal government literally falling over each other to try to take a piece of his hide. And many people thought it was a little bit over the top as you sort of pile on these death penalty offenses, but everyone wanted their own conviction, and one could certainly understand the emotive value of that. This is going to be the case here. The Arizona prosecutors are going to want to charge him with murder under state law. The feds have already moved and charged him. The interesting thing is that they're going to charge him with the murder of federal employees in the course of their duties. They're saying that the judge in this case, who went to see this outdoor event, yep, was actually on official duty because he wanted to ask the congresswoman what she was going to do about the heavy docket of federal judges.
And so that being official business, of course, her employees, also federal employees, were there on official business. But the idea of, all right, you're being charged with the murder of a federal judge, which is, we now believe, caught on cameras, on digital recordings, and you're going to be tried in federal court. Good luck.
Yeah. Well, there's certain times when, you have to make lemonade out of lemons. And that certainly is a case where your client is on camera committing a horrendous offense. What you look for then are threshold issues, such as this issue of whether they were on official duty and the propriety of using the statute against this individual. Those provisions are going to drive the sentencing here, and you can attack those as a legal matter. And then the other question is going to be the competence issue and whether you can, in fact, establish that. But you have to remember that, Ted Kaczynski that you just mentioned, he was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, but he was still found to be sane. You know, in her first trial, Andrea Yates, who had killed 5 children, had a history of paranoid schizophrenia, had just been in the mental hospital 2 weeks earlier. She was found to be sane. Now, that was ultimately overturned, but it shows you how difficult this is, where, you had people like Colin Ferguson, Zacharias Moussaoui. These are barking lunatics who were found to be sane under the federal or state standards.
Yet not all of them were sentenced to death.
That's right. But it can end up in a really horrific scene for lawyers. Colin Ferguson, who by most people's measure was a barking lunatic, not only was found to be sane, but because he was found to be sane, he was allowed to be his own lawyer. And it led to a circus.
Well, joining us now to help us out on this point is David Bruck, a law professor and director of the Virginia Capital Case Clearinghouse. He's consulted on a number of cases that fall into the kind of categories we're talking about. He joins us from his office at Washington and Lee University School of Law. Nice of you to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And as a defense attorney in a case where the facts are not in doubt, what do you try to prove to the jury?
Well, it depends which facts you mean. It's very often the case that there's no doubt about what the defendant did, but in any criminal case, and especially in a case where the prosecution asks for the death penalty, the question of who he is and why he did it is front and center. And those facts are in doubt in most cases, especially where there's a great deal of evidence of severe mental illness. It's way too early in this case to say whether Mr. Loeffner is afflicted by severe mental illness, but from what's been reported in the press, the question certainly arises, and people are thinking about it. And the first task of the defense attorney is to make sure that all of the evidence that can possibly be gathered on that issue is gathered, and that means a painstaking background investigation that goes has the defense talking to, seeking out, finding everybody that knew this young man across the whole span of his life, and even looking back in the medical records of his family over several generations. So there's really no stone that can be left unturned to find out not just what he did, which may be known to everybody, but why.
You've worked with Judy Clark, Mr. Loeffner's defense attorney, in the past. The consensus that I've read is that she's the best.
She is. She's handled cases like this. She's represented clients, including Ted Kaczynski, with severe mental illness. And it's often, you know, some of the cases that Judy Clark has handled really illustrate the point that appearances can be very deceiving. When Ted Kaczynski was first arrested, people thought of him primarily as a political extremist, and I suppose he was that, but he also clearly was and probably still is a man suffering from, as Jonathan points out, paranoid schizophrenia. His thoughts about ecology and the lumber companies and all are famous, but what's less well known is that the man was driven out to live in a packing crate in the mountains of Montana mainly by a fixed delusion that his mother and father were trying to kill him. That's really what dominated his life. That is the face of mental illness, and this isn't something that anybody chooses. This is something that happens to you. That's the story of how someone goes from being a brilliant mathematics graduate student at Berkeley to being Ted Kaczynski.
But is Jonathan right? Is the prospect here to minimize what you fear will be the damage?
The question of the insanity defense of not guilty by reason of insanity is always something that a lawyer has to look at very carefully when there is evidence of mental illness. But that is the original stacked deck. I mean, as Jonathan points out, after the Hinckley case, the insanity defense was narrowed down to the eye of a needle. Almost no one can thread it. It's not only that the standard is very, very narrow, but the burden of proof is such that it instead of being on the government, it's on the accused, and the burden of proof is now by clear and convincing evidence, which is a very high standard of proof that Congress has really decided that in this particular case, it's better to let 10 innocent men be convicted than to let one guilty man go free. It really is the opposite of the normal presumption. And on top of all that, the jury is not told in federal cases or in most insanity cases that the law provides very, very strict protections to make sure that someone acquitted by reason of insanity is not set free. That is the law, but the jury is not told that.
We're talking about defending the indefensible. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. There's little doubt about what happened last month in Tucson. Dozens watched as a suspect shot Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and then turned his gun on the crowd. Jared Lee Loeffner has pled not guilty to federal charges. His attorney faces the challenge of defending a client who many already believe guilty. We're talking today about defending the indefensible. We want to hear from those of you who've been involved in cases where the defendant's guilt was not really in question. From defense lawyers, prosecutors, victims, jurors, tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are Jonathan Turley, a lawyer and professor of public interest law at George Washington University, and David Bruck, also an attorney who's consulted in the past with the defense lawyer now representing Loeffner. He's also director of the Virginia Capital Case Clearinghouse. Let's get a caller in, and this is Matt. Matt with us from Detroit.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I handle many capital cases here in the Detroit metropolitan area. And I've always looked at my role is to make sure that my client gets a fair shake and make sure that the people prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And I've had what the actions that my client took are not in question. However, is he guilty of what is really the true question? And that would be, I had a case in December where a guy comes home, his wife, they were separated, is in bed with another man. Okay, he stabs her, he stabs them, nobody died, so he's charged with assault with intent to murder. Well, we were able to convince the jury that because of his mental state, he didn't have the mindset or the requisite intent to form the formulation that it's a murder, actually, and so he was found guilty of a lesser offense. And now, obviously in Tucson, I think it's a more daunting chance for the attorney, but I've always attacked it from the standpoint that you're going to make the people prove their case.
Of course. How much does publicity make a difference? Obviously, the Loeffner case, everybody's going to know about that.
I think when it comes to jury selection, obviously it's it's important. Now, if your judges are elected, I think it's extremely important. I think that how a press case is handled in Michigan, where we elect judges, what we would term as a press case and the one that really got no attention, is handled quite a bit different by the judges, and they have to face the people. So, yes, I think it makes a huge difference.
David Bruck, I wondered to bring you in on that. How much difference does it make? Well, this is obviously a very high-profile case in Tucson.
Well, it probably makes more difference, on the way that the prosecution handles the case. There is going to be political pressure on the government, for example, to seek the death penalty, where based on the evidence of if this man does turn out to be severely mentally ill, there would be less reason for the government to do that in a lower profile case. I'm inclined to think that the Attorney General will probably decide this case on the facts rather than on public pressure, and for that reason I don't think it's at all a foregone conclusion that the death penalty will even be asked for, much less imposed in this case.
That's in federal court. There's also going to be state charges.
Well, the way the prosecution handles the case, I think certainly these are elected public officials, and they are responsive to public pressure. My experience generally, and I think most people that work in this system, is the juries are more impervious to that. There's a tendency to screen out a lot of the noise. Part of the effect of publicity that creates more of a challenge for the lawyer is just that the lawyer has to screen out the noise. When you are first appointed to represent a person like Jared Loughner, it just seems like you've been dropped inside of an industrial washing machine. There's just such a horrible racket, and the media is descending on you. The challenge for the lawyer is just to absolutely tune that out. I mean, to think about whether there is something that has to be said to the media for a particular purpose to defend the client. But other than that, just to sort of get yourself to a calm place where you can focus on the needs of the client and on protecting the client. That's something that Judy Clark is especially good at doing. She just doesn't really notice the fact that there's this huge high-profile racket going on around her. But in the end, I'm not sure, other than the effect on the decisions by prosecutors, I'm not sure that the public high-profile nature of the case really does make all that much difference.
Jonathan Turley, does that cut the other way? You can have an occasional defense attorney who is a charismatic personality and can say my client was orphaned at the age of 3 days and has suffered terribly in his youth, and these terrible things have happened to him, and blah blah blah, and try to play to the public. Does that not work particularly well, Evie?
Well, first of all, many of these cases you're under gag orders with the court. You're certainly under ethical restrictions about what you can say publicly. It's also not a good move to make to try to litigate cases in public. You do have a duty to respond to your client. Hopefully, if you prevail, is going to have to go out into the world. I mean, when I represented Danny King, who was accused of being a Russian spy, one of the first things I did after we won that case was to arrange for him to go back to his small town and invite everyone to the local gymnasium so they could ask every question they wanted to ask. You really need to look ahead as well as to what shape you're going to leave your client at the end of this.
Let's go next to John. John with us from Goodyear, Arizona.
How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah, I want to say a lot, but I'll consolidate it to a really quick comment. It seems like to me this is almost the kind of situation where the judicial system puts itself, kind of like on a soapbox or, on a platform. Ultimately, we have a situation where, like you said, the guy's seen by many people. He's on film. It's a waste of time to make such a circus out of it. But we see this is where everybody's able to see all the wheels of justice, if you will, turning. Yet, I'm a correctional officer, and I can tell you there's a lot of people in prison. And I'm not really giving, my opinion about individual cases. But there's a lot of people in prison where I believe, as a correctional officer and a citizen, where there was horrible miscarriages of justice. People that are serving time for crimes, you know, that we're paying for the trials, we're paying for them to be in prison, where they could be out and being productive members of society, where a guy like Gerald Lutner will never be a productive member of society again, no matter how long his trial is or what witnesses are called or experts. It's going to end up the same. He's going to be in prison until he dies. So why are we carrying this out when, ultimately, it's already known what he's done? There's no question. He's going to be in prison.
Jonathan Turley, let me put that to you. This is going to cost first the federal government, then the state of Arizona, a lot of money.
Well, justice isn't cheap. I mean, the fact is you can't do it on the cheap. You have to convict someone if you are going to convict them in full knowledge of not only what they did but who they are. And understanding a crime and the criminal does not mean you agree with it, but you have to try to understand the motivations. Many of these are intent crimes. Scienter is required to establish what the intent was. And I have to tell you, after 30 years of practice, the greatest variety of clients and defendants that I have met have been murderers. They come in the greatest variety. I expect that David has found the same thing. And so we have a duty to get it right, even if we are convinced as to the merits. And I also want to point out that there have been many cases where everyone agreed on the merits that someone was guilty and they proved to be innocent.
Here's an email that we have from Lane, in California. Everyone deserves the right to defend themselves in court, even when it's obvious they committed the crime. I, however, find it annoying that NPR and other news outlets have been referring to Jared Loughner as the accused and not the perpetrator. We don't need a guilty verdict to know he committed this crime. There were many witnesses, and he was caught in the act, and it seems a bit pedantic to insist on calling him the accused, and we sometimes use the suspect, until the time of conviction. In cases like this, you should let the rule of not prejudging go and just call a duck a duck. Well, that's a question for journalism and not for lawyers, but we try to stick to the rules we write for ourselves, and that says until you're convicted, you're the accused, or you're a suspect, and you're not guilty until you're proven guilty, however silly that may seem at various times. But as Jonathan says, every once in a while, there's a surprise. So let's see if we go next to, let's go to Alan. Alan with us from Davenport in Iowa.
Yes, I have a question. I've been listening to all the thing, and it's just a technical question. I was curious, does the insanity defense have to be used in connection with the crime, for instance? Like, the guy could believe pigs fly, but yet that has no relation to a murder, for instance.
David Bruck?
Well, that's a good question. Insanity defense could only be proven if it's established that the defendant didn't appreciate the wrongfulness of what he did, of the actual crime. So sure, someone who is mentally ill but that it's just a coincidence and that happens to have nothing to do with the crime would not make out the insanity defense. That may not be something that happens that terribly often when you're talking about severe mental illness like paranoid schizophrenia, but it could happen. The other thing about mental illness, though, is that even if there is no insanity defense, or even if one is presented and rejected, there remains the issue of punishment. And especially if the prosecution seeks the death penalty, the effect of the person's mental illness on his thinking, on his motivation, is tremendously important for deciding whether a given convicted murderer is one of those 1 or 2% who deserve the death penalty, the most guilty, the most culpable, or whether life imprisonment without the possibility of parole is punishment enough. That's the punishment that 99% of murderers get anyway, and it would be very hard to imagine how a severely mentally ill person could, in justice and fairness, fall into that most guilty 1% rather than the 99% who do not receive the death penalty. The death penalty also is a large part of the reason why these cases cost so much. If the decision is made to forego that, the taxpayers will save an enormous amount and the case will be enormously simplified.
And let me ask a related question from email from Tamark in Chagrin Falls in Ohio. I always thought that just by virtue of committing a heinous public act like the shootings by Jared Loughner, that one can assume the suspect is mentally ill. A sane person wouldn't dream of doing such a thing. Please comment.
Well, I don't know if that's entirely true. I mean, there are people driven by political motivation. Assassins, not all assassins are by definition insane, although they do terrible, terrible things. I think it really is a question that depends on the facts of of the individual case, and we really need to look at these cases one at a time. You could say that anybody that commits a crime must not be normal, and I suppose in some sense that's true, but that doesn't tell you whether they're legally guilty, and it doesn't tell you what the punishment should be if they're convicted.
Okay. Alan, thanks very much for the call. We're talking about defending the indefensible. Our guest, David Bruck, you just heard, a clinical professor of law and director of the Virginia Capital Case Clearinghouse, and Jonathan Turley, a professor of public interest law at George Washington University. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Rick, and Rick's with us from Albany, Georgia.
Hi, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm a criminal defense attorney in Albany, Georgia, and one thing that I've noticed over the years is that as a social control, oftentimes juries will convict out of fear because they don't want the mentally ill in a restaurant with them, out at the mall, or so forth, even though the evidence may not prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. They're just afraid to have these people back out into society, and our prisons have become very much a warehouse for the mentally ill.
Jonathan Turley?
Well, that's a very good point. One of the things that you have to track very closely is how those types of feelings by the jury may affect your case. You know, I have to agree with something David said earlier, that I think we often sell juries short. Not that the caller's selling them short. I think that's a very solid point. But, when I represented the so-called Dr. Play case of Dr. Butler in Texas, in Lubbock, Texas, this was a small town that was sent into a absolute panic over the allegation that plague had been given to Al-Qaeda operatives. And we spent a lot of money trying to get a venue change, to get out of Lubbock. I wanted to be anywhere but Lubbock. And, a very seasoned criminal defense attorney told me, pulled me aside and said, look, I know you're going to try to get out of Lubbock, but you should understand the jurors in Lubbock, they'll give them a fair hearing. And they did. You know, we lost the venue, but they ruled in favor of our client on all the national security counts. And I think the jurors do attend an important task there. You're limited to some extent in what you can tell a jury as to what will happen to the defendant later. And certainly the prosecutors are often challenged for raising this. Sometimes prosecutors will intimate that you sure better find him guilty and sentence him to death or he could end up back out of jail. Mm-hmm. That's something that can get a prosecutor in serious trouble.
Rick, thanks very much. And let's see if we can get Allison in. Allison with us from Charlotte.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Oh, well, I was calling because we were family member victims of the Atlanta courthouse killing that you mentioned at the top of the hour.
Yes, Mr.
And
Nichols.
And I was calling, I guess, from a victim's perspective.
And it's interesting. He was eventually, the to get the death penalty, the jury required a unanimous verdict. I wondered how you felt at that moment.
Well, I mean, it's very complicated because, he was guilty. It was certainly not anything that was questionable, but it came down to, for the jury, whether you were for the death penalty or against the death penalty.
And what did you think as a family member?
Well, I mean, we were, in all honesty, disappointed that what we found out later, the jurors who voted against the death penalty had pretty much had their minds made up beforehand. They were doing crossword puzzles, and, when I gave my victim testimony, wouldn't even look me in the eye. So I think that the death penalty really is, it's a problem for some people to deal with, but the state of Georgia has that as a law. The prosecutors needed and deservedly so for, there was a judge that was killed, a court reporter, and a federal agent, and other people. And if you're going to have the law, you have to, that's the perfect case to have a death penalty case.
There was, just to clarify, obviously there was a unanimous verdict. You had to have a unanimous recommendation for the death penalty in the state of Georgia. And David Brucker, we just have a few seconds left, but I wondered if you wanted to reply to that.
Well, I certainly understand how the caller must have felt. Victims' families are like the rest of the public in that they react differently. People respond very differently to these horrible crimes, and I think wherever they stand on the issue of the death penalty, I think we should keep in mind that since so few people are sentenced to the death penalty, that is probably not a good way for us to rely on.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there. Thanks very much for your time. This is NPR News.